This is not CGI. It's neither a sci-fi video game nor a movie. This is the town of Vorkuta, Russia, and it's all too real for the 70,000 people who call it home. Virtually everything about Vorkuta screams don't live here, starting with the extreme difficulty of getting there. Nearly 100 miles north of the Arctic Circle, it's the easternmost town in Europe. With no roads in or out, the only ways to or from Vorkuta are a 40-hour train ride or one of the 2 to 3 weekly flights, assuming they're unimpeded by blizzards. Because of this, those who move away are liable to just leave behind their cars and apartments with everything in them, which is how you get apocalyptic scenes like these. During the winter, temperatures can drop as low as negative 58 degrees Fahrenheit. The sun appears for just an hour on the average December day. Then, after enduring this for 8 long months, residents are rewarded with a brief 70-day intermission when the snow melts, revealing the city's bright Soviet-era buildings underneath. Clearly, Mother Nature would prefer Vorkuta remain a vast, untouched reindeer sanctuary. So, why does the city exist at all? What kind of person would move here? Initially, the kind who didn't have a choice. Prisoners. Chosen precisely for its isolation, the town was once home to one of the largest and most notorious of the Soviet Union's forced labor camps. Later, after Stalin's death and the end of the Gulag, Moscow invested billions of rubles transforming distant Arctic settlements like Vorkuta into shining, triumphant symbols of the empire. Conquering nature was no less a political as a practical project. Like Mao's obsession with dams, Vorkuta and places like it were irrefutable physical testaments to the power of socialism. These towns, some though not all in Siberia, were usually designed around a single industry, sometimes even a single factory. In Vorkuta, that industry was coal mining. Further south, another one produces asbestos. In fact, the town is named after the known carcinogen, which it still mines to this day. In total, there are about 300 Russian monotowns, of which Vorkuta is neither the furthest north, most remote, nor even the coldest. Take, for example, Norilsk, a nickel mine masquerading as a city of 200,000 people. Entry is strictly off-limits to foreigners, which may be a good thing, considering it's one of the world's most polluted cities. Its hazy brown air and toxic, discolored water make Vorkuta, by comparison, look like Disneyland. Despite this, thousands pack their bags and cheerfully move to places like Norilsk and Vorkuta in the 70s and 80s thanks to the Soviet system of social welfare. Although the retirement age was set very generously at just 55 for women and 60 for men, you could retire even earlier and collect an even larger pension if you met certain conditions. Conditions like working in a mine, or better yet, working in a mine in the middle of nowhere. That placed Vorkuta right in the bullseye of the Venn diagram. Young Russians could move to the Arctic, do a few years of hard labor, and then retire early down on the Crimean beach. But all that came to an end on Christmas Day 1991. The collapse of the Soviet Union meant the collapse of the entire economic model on which these monotowns were based. Suddenly, these mines, factories, and power plants were thrown out to the wolves, forced to fend for themselves on the global market. After a lifetime of artificial state support, how could they possibly compete? So what happened next was as predictable as it was tragic. Bankruptcies led to layoffs, layoffs led to poverty, poverty to crime, and crime to mass migration. A quarter of Vorkuta fled in the 4 years between 1998 and 2002. Meanwhile, the 1998 financial crisis had reduced the value of Russian pensions by nearly 50%. In short, seniors were on the verge of financial ruin. And what little social welfare remained was often inconsistent or ineffective. Retired teachers might be entitled to free bus rides where public transit no longer existed. These, but not those, veterans might be granted free phone service, etc. This was the Russia that Vladimir Putin inherited at the turn of the millennium. The entire social welfare system was in dire need of an overhaul. And his first attempt to fix it was called the monetization of benefits. Rather than maintain 230 different complex, outdated categories of benefits, the idea was, why not just give people cash and let them decide what to do with it? In truth, it was a fairly modest proposal with entirely reasonable intentions. But the government failed to communicate its plan effectively. What's more, the Kremlin delegated implementation to individual regions, leading to geographic disparities. Russians, everywhere from downtown St. Petersburg to rural Siberia, were furious. Thousands of protesters descended on the streets, shouting "Down with Putin" and waving nostalgic Soviet flags. In their eyes, this was not a mere change in policy. It was nothing less than a giant middle finger to their years of hard labor and national service. These coal miners traveled all the way from Vorkuta to protest in the streets of Moscow. That's like swimming from Guam to the White House lawn. For Putin, the message was loud and clear. Don't touch pensions or anything resembling pensions with a 10-foot pole. Pensioners became a critical base of support for his party, United Russia. In 2005, on the subject of raising the retirement age, Putin declared unequivocally on television, quote, "This decision will not be taken while I am president."
И пока я президент, такого решения принято не будет.
He later called pensions the Soviet Union's greatest achievement. And after seeing how the issue of social welfare inspired political interest even in Siberian coal miners, his government paid particular attention to these remote, decaying monotowns, home to a large number of retirees. The Kremlin was so concerned that it tasked the Federal Protective Service, Russia's equivalent to the Secret Service, with conducting, quote, "sociological surveys." These undercover agents identified 54 monotowns as having the greatest risk of unrest, with another 104 not far behind. Thus, while other ex-communist countries like Poland and Hungary encouraged the residents of their Rust Belt towns to slowly migrate toward jobs, Russia saw them as delicate kindling, waiting for the tiniest spark to ignite a wildfire. Less risky to simply keep these dying regions on life support, handing out just enough busy work to ensure scarce time for any extracurricular activities. These factories may not produce anything tangible of value, but what they do produce are votes for United Russia. High employment plus rising pensions equals harmony. The first way it achieves this harmony is with a wildly bloated bureaucracy. In 2011, nearly 20% of the entire national labor force was employed by the state. And that's not counting state-owned companies, another 12%. In fact, the pension fund itself employs over 100,000 people, 60% more than its American counterpart, despite serving a population half as large. You know there's a problem when the American government looks like an efficient, well-oiled machine by comparison. Secondly, the Kremlin collaborates with, or more accurately, threatens businesses. Oligarchs may be given an incredibly long leash in Russia, but one red line they definitely don't dare cross are excessive layoffs. Shut down an unprofitable factory in a politically sensitive area, and you might suddenly develop a dangerous habit of falling out of windows. When times are tough, oligarchs wisely try just about anything under the sun before resorting to layoffs, including deferring paychecks, slowing down recruitment, and giving workers unplanned extended holidays. Finally, monotowns are directly subsidized. In 2010 alone, $846 million were allocated to 27 towns. That's how the Kremlin keeps baseline dissatisfaction low. But Putin also sprinkles in some sweet carrots, particularly before an important election. As you can see, pensions have increased substantially since the year 2000. They more than doubled between 2012 and 22. Now, Russian pensions have never been large. The average amount is only $222 a month. But remember, this is a country where the mean annual income is about $8,000. For 93% of its 46 million pensioners, this is the only thing keeping them from extreme poverty. To call these retirees single-issue voters is a massive understatement. Either they receive these pensions, or they starve. It's that simple. And given the sheer size of this voting bloc, one-third of the whole country, Putin's extraordinarily high approval should be no surprise. Over the course of his career, Putin perfected this high employment, rising pension, social harmony formula. But this incredible success was deceiving. Beneath this band-aid, the infection was getting worse. A lot worse. And to see why, we need to take a brief step back. In their simplest form, the way pensions work is that one group pays into a giant pool of money, and another group withdraws out of that same pool of money. In other words, the whole concept requires a balance of payers and payees. This is what that balance looked like before the Soviet Union collapsed. The 1991 population broken down by age, from young at the bottom to old on top. Better yet, let's ignore the kids, combine everyone aged 20 to 54 into one contributor group, and anyone older into a single recipient group. Take it all in, and now compare that 1991 balance to this 2021 balance. As you can see, the Soviet Union was playing welfare on easy mode, with much fewer recipients. Immediately after its fall, the number of new births collapsed. And for every one of the last 32 years since, Russia has gotten considerably older, tilting pensions off balance, with 44% more recipients and slightly fewer contributors. The writing has been on the wall for 3 decades. The math simply doesn't add up. And there's no doubt Putin knew this. But to peel back the band-aid and confront the root cause would mean risking a larger, potentially regime-threatening version of what happened back in 2004. So he waited, and waited, and waited, until the inevitable could be delayed no longer. To regain balance, the recipient group had to shrink, and the contributor group had to grow. Which meant Putin had to do what he vowed never to do 13 years earlier on television: raise the retirement age. This time, however, he had a plan. On June 14, 2018, while Russian soccer fans were busy cheering their defeat of Saudi Arabia on the opening day of the World Cup, Putin made his move. The retirement age was quietly increased from 60 to 65 for men and from 55 to 63 for women. With this one change, the Russian retirement age went from one of the world's most generous, unchanged since its establishment by Joseph Stalin in the early 1900s, to one of the world's least generous. To make matters worse, these changes were implemented much faster than in most countries. The United States, for example, is very slowly raising its retirement age by just 2 years in total over the course of 2 decades. Needless to say, this was not well received. This is Putin's popularity since 1999, and this 15% drop in approval is when the announcement was made. In days, Putin lost most of the surge in support he gained from the annexation of Crimea in 2014. This was, in fact, the largest short-term collapse in approval he's ever seen, before or since. And by January, the public's level of trust in Putin fell to just 33%, with a full 50% preferring the resignation of his cabinet. The backlash was so intense that his administration eventually lowered the retirement age again, this time from 63 to 60 for women. Though this concession failed to address one of the most common complaints: a huge number of Russians will never see a dime. Earlier, we saw this population pyramid dividing the country into age groups. But this graph obscures a massive imbalance. To see it, we have to split each age cohort by gender. In case it's still unclear, let's show only the excess men or women for each age group. Notice the pattern? Down here, men very slightly outnumber women. Here, between ages 30 and 34, the two groups are roughly equal. And then from there, women start to rapidly eclipse men. By the time you reach age 70, there are 3 women for every 1 man. The simple, unfortunate reality is that Russian men don't live very long. Poor healthcare, physically arduous labor, plus off-the-charts alcohol consumption will do that. To be clear, its life expectancy has increased substantially in recent years, credit where credit is due. But that comes after decades of decline. You heard that right. Between 1960 and 94, the average Russian lost 3 years of their life. But that's both men and women. The male life expectancy is dramatically lower, a mere 66 years today. And even that's just a national average. In poor rural regions, the male life expectancy is much, much lower. Remember Norilsk from earlier? Its life expectancy is 59, and almost certainly lower for men, most of whom work in nickel mines. That leaves its average resident with a retirement of negative 6 years. Even the average Russian male can only expect a year. So you can probably see why the 2018 change wasn't met with glee. Now, I won't bore you with the implications of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the pandemic which overwhelmed its already underfunded healthcare system, or the Western sanctions on all manner of its exports. But suffice to say, whatever demographic and fiscal problems the country had 5 years ago, things are much worse now. The beautiful thing about demographics is that they allow you to peer into the future. There are fewer Russian teenagers today, so there will be fewer pension fund contributors tomorrow. But the devastating thing about demographics is that, for the most part, they're fixed. Today's teenagers are 13-year-old ripples of actions past. Unless Putin invents a time machine or immigrants flock to a country whose passport is becoming less powerful by the day, there's no short-term solution. The ratio of old to young will only continue to grow, shifting the pension balance ever more precariously toward a large number of seniors. Which means the 2018 change won't be the last. Sooner or later, Putin will be forced to confront reality. This is not unique to Russia. Far from it. Most of Europe has it even worse. Pension protests will soon become a regular feature of the global news cycle. But there's one critical difference. Take a second look at Putin's approval rating. Now, consider everything Russians have tolerated during these 24 years. Election fraud, a failing education system, rampant corruption, crackdowns on civil society, rising inflation, and most recently, a draft. And yet, throughout all of it, Putin maintained an average approval of 74%. The one thing that did move the needle were pensions. No retiree in any corner of the globe favors a decrease in their income, of course. But only Russian retirees have put up with so much in exchange. Take away pensions and the trade becomes everything for nothing. Take away pensions and the entire social contract supporting the modern Russian state falls apart. That is the challenge facing Putin. He might find some solutions with the help of ChatGPT if only he had access to this class on today's sponsor, Skillshare, about how to use large language models effectively. You might think, as I did, that since the whole point of an AI is to understand your request, you don't need to learn how to use it. But ChatGPT is merely a tool, and like any tool, there are tricks and techniques you can employ to produce a better result. When I started getting more strategic with my prompts, I instantly went from ChatGPT skeptic to believer, and this class can do the same for you, whether you plan on using it professionally or merely for fun. This is just one of thousands of courses you can find on Skillshare, including my courses in which I show you how I make these videos, now watched by over 23,000 people. An annual subscription costs less than 10 bucks a month, but the first 1,000 people to join with the link on screen get a 1-month free trial. Thanks to Skillshare for sponsoring this video.